Monday, April 21, 2025. News sites globally announce the death of Pope Francis, aged 88. Even though his health has been fragile for months, the news still stuns. Hello there, Andrew West with you on this Christmas Day, bringing you a special program on the biggest religious story of 2025. Now, on that day, Colm Flynn from the Catholic broadcaster EWTN is in St. Peter's Square as the news breaks, just hours after Francis has given his Easter Sunday blessing.
You go back just 24 hours, and that same basilica was packed with the most beautiful flowers from the Netherlands. The Swiss Guard marching through, you had bands playing, you had the Vatican Choir singing, all for the jubilous Mass for Easter Sunday. And then, of course, the Pope coming to the balcony, the crowd erupting when he said, "Brothers and sisters, good morning, and I wish you a very happy Easter." So it was a triumphant day yesterday, because that's what Easter is all about, the triumph of Jesus being resurrected from the dead, good winning over evil, light over darkness. And so incredibly poignant to wake up this morning here in Rome to the news that at 7:35 a.m. Rome time, the Holy Father, the successor of Peter, that he had passed away.
Claire Giangrave from the Religion News Service is also at the Vatican. She tells us why the Pope's funeral will be so much more than a religious rite. The guest list will make it a major geopolitical event.
We have a confirmation that President Trump will be attending. President Zelensky of Ukraine will also be coming to the funeral. Putin has said that he will not be there, but he did issue a very appreciative comment on Pope Francis's life and legacy. And as you mentioned, princes. The Prince of Wales will go instead of King Charles, who was one of the last prominent figures to meet Pope Francis in person. And then we have a huge slew of representatives coming from Europe. Of course, Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, but also Emmanuel Macron from France. And then there will be the Ursula von der Leyen as a high-ranking member of the European Union and the President of the Parliament of the European Union as well. So it will really be an A-list of all these representatives from governments and countries who are there to testify to the lasting impact of Pope Francis's diplomacy and peacekeeping efforts.
Yeah, we want to emphasize it is a funeral, of course, but it is a global event. What is in it for world leaders to attend? Because we can't imagine that they all had close personal relationships with the Pope. What's in it for them?
Well, of course, many of them have met with the Pope on several occasions. And the truth is that the Vatican, and especially under Pope Francis, has a tremendous importance on the global stage. The Vatican is an institution, and its head, the pontiff, that goes beyond boundaries, it goes beyond regions, and it goes even beyond its 1.4 billion Catholics. Being present at the funeral of a pope is also a way to not just pay respect to the Catholics who see him as a spiritual leader. And let's be honest, even more than Catholics, he's the most significant and recognizable Christian leader in the world. Mm. And more than that, to also position themselves in a way of saying, well, this is the relationship that's important to us.
Yeah, I did notice, though, even before it seemed a formal invitation was extended, I could be wrong on that, but it certainly seemed that Donald Trump just announced he would be there. Is his presence likely to loom over the event?
He did announce very quickly that he was going to attend, and it surprised some people. I spoke to some analysts who spent their life studying Vatican diplomacy and its relations with other states. And they noted, of course, first thing, that Melania, Trump's wife, is Catholic, so probably she wants to be present at this moment. They also noted that J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States, was the last person to see the Pope alive as a prominent dignitary. And one day later, the Pope died. Mm. So when Vance went back to the United States, could it be possible that he encouraged Trump to be present? And let's not forget that one of the meetings that Vance had as he walked around Rome and the Vatican just in the days leading up to Easter was with the Secretary of State of the Vatican, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. And Parolin is considered a papabile. That word means a candidate who is likely to become pope. So looms, yes, in the sense that Trump being at this funeral says that this relationship is important to the United States. Why is this relationship important? Because Catholics were instrumental in many ways, data shows, in electing Trump, and his vice president is Catholic. Being present there sends a message back home. And let's not forget that for a long time during these years, Pope Francis loomed over Trump's presidency.
Yeah.
He criticized Trump for his views on migrants. He called his policies on mass deportations disgraceful. He urged him to take a keen interest in the Paris Climate Accords, and he was frustrated by the U.S. president's emphasis on populist and individualistic tendencies. So now that the Pope is dead, it's correct to say that Trump will be looming on this funeral, and maybe sending a message of the United States interest, not just in this papacy, but in what comes next.
What follows the death of a beloved Pope Francis is a truly historic event. His funeral and final journey to the Basilica St. Maria Maggiore is simulcast across ABC radio and television. Claire Johnson from the Australian Catholic University and the ABC's Jeremy Fernandez reflect on how the multi-ethnic nature of the service echoes Francis's style of papacy.
These bells tolling out are sort of a solemn conclusion to this part of the funeral. For most of the lay people, most of the people present there, they won't be actually able to participate in the next section because it will be a private burial. Obviously, with crowds so huge, they can't fit them in to Santa Maria Maggiore, St. Mary Major Church. It's about 7 kilometres away from the Vatican, and it will take some time for the Pope's body in procession to be taken there. I believe the streets are lined with people waiting to pay their final respects to him. But this tolling bell is a way to sort of signal the conclusion of this part of the liturgy. Interestingly, the people were not dismissed because the funeral hasn't finished. The funeral only finishes when Pope Francis is interred, or entombed in this case, and the prayers are said at that point. So it's sort of an almost finish, but not quite, because we have the third part of this final journey of Pope Francis yet to come.
It was a deeply moving service, Claire, and there were some distinct touches of Pope Francis that were very, very clear throughout that requiem.
Absolutely. It's very interesting to note the decisions that must have been conveyed very clearly to those arranging this funeral. We had a funeral that's very familiar to Roman Catholics who have experienced requiem masses all over the world, but yet there were some distinctive elements here. In particular, the reinforcement of his status as the Bishop of Rome, the inclusion of that prayer specifically from the Cardinal Vicar General, who is running the Diocese of Rome on behalf of the Pope. And of course, that most beautiful section from the Byzantine funeral liturgy, celebrated and led by leaders of the Eastern Catholic Rites with their own choir, that distinctive sound coming through as they were singing in Greek there. It was reinforcing that death has no victory here. Death has been defeated. And the strength of those male voices really underscored that, I think, as they were singing those wonderful words in Greek. Very consoling and beautiful prayers we heard from our Eastern Catholic brothers and sisters. Also, the inclusion of lots of lay people in ministries within this celebration was marked, I think, and intentional. Including all of the different languages that we heard in this liturgy was also Francis extending his reach globally one last time here by drawing all of those people in and letting them find their own place.
But pretty soon, the politics begins. The conclave to choose a new pope dominates the news. The ABC's senior religion specialist Noel Debien is in Rome. He begins delving deeply into the manoeuvring inside the Vatican.
there are two major camps going on here. One is a sort of a revisionist camp that wants to go back before Pope Francis reversed what he's doing, and that's led by some fairly wealthy Americans in particular. And then there's another group who are very much pushing for a Francis-like pope. And so a lot of these things we're seeing, they tend to be leaked by either side. So Cardinal Cerny, for example, a Jesuit, who is reported to have said, I can think of some African cardinals, they make me shudder. You've got to think about what the context was, how and where did he actually say this? And that is a way of sort of undermining anything he's got to say. And he is saying something also, which is complicated because, of course, in some African countries, homosexuality, which is what he was talking about, their approaches to social mores, homosexuality is bad. It's illegal. Mm. It's a jailable offence. So you've got a reality that the social circumstances, the culture of different parts of the Catholic Church is radically different. And you have to see it in that context of what he's talking about.
Yeah, what's Cardinal Müller of Germany been saying? Because he's been very open as well. He represents the conservative grouping.
Well, he does. And what struck me is that both sides appear to be leaking, which is the progressive side and the conservative side. Cardinal Stellar, actually, Claire mentioned Cardinal Stellar, and he said this in the New York Times, reported in the New York Times, which is quite reliable, that Pope Francis was like a dictator and that we had to escape from this. And he was backed up by American Cardinal Burke, who said, you know, in terms of canon law, this pope was not good. And this sort of stuff has been going on. But reportedly, inside that general congregation room, which is the meeting of all the cardinals, not just the electors, they were not being persuaded. As you know, we're working on the edges of it all, and no cardinal goes on record for the most part. The New York Times has got different context, but not within the general congregations. So a lot of it is educated comment on hints that are given by cardinals who are saying what they think the church would need.
Noel, have we heard anything from Australia's lone cardinal, Cardinal Bechok, the Ukrainian Catholic cardinal from Melbourne?
Well, Mykola Bechok it's his first conclave. He's 44, he's the youngest cardinal there. In fact, I was standing nearby. Some of the cardinals come out from the Synod Hall and they're willing to talk to some of the press. They don't talk about, oh, what I'm trying to vote is this. They don't do that. But they do say what I think is important. There was one Asian cardinal standing next to us the other day saying, synodality is essential. We must maintain synodality. And that's, you know, the big ticket Pope Francis issue, and he's willing to say that. That's on the edge for reporting what's going on inside. But Bechok is not one of those cardinals who jumps out into the press. Like, some of them love it. Like, it's clear that they're going, oh, I'll give you something here. Here, you know, feeding the chooks, Joe Bjelke-Peterson used to talk about. But they will do it, but others really don't like it. Others will go, no, no, good morning, everybody, have a lovely day. Good morning, everybody, have a lovely day. And they just keep going. Yeah. And Cardinal Bechok is not one to jump into the melee. And in fact, when we saw him 2 days ago outside the Senate, a car came down right to the gate to pick him up and to take him home. And as far as I can see, that's the Australian bishops organising things well for him so he doesn't have to face the press melee, because it's a lot of pressure. And he did say in his initial conference with us, press conference, that he was aware of the enormous responsibility that he held.
After only 2 days and just 4 ballots in the Sistine Chapel, a stunning and historic choice. The College of 133 Cardinals chooses an American-born prelate, Robert Francis Prevost. He takes the name Leo XIV. He's inaugurated in a special mass on the 8th of May.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
Papal historian Miles Pattenden of Oxford University immediately looks ahead to Pope Leo's first 100 days and his new priorities.
Well, I think probably the most pressing priority is to get the Vatican itself into some semblance of order. We know that Pope Francis, for all his very many admirable qualities, wasn't perhaps the best manager and administrator, and the problems within the Vatican seem to have multiplied over the past 12 years, especially financial problems. The Vatican said to have a multi-million euro pensions deficit, which will need to be addressed. But there are also lots of administrative issues, including questions of corruption, and those intersect into questions about the cover-up of sexual abuse in various parts of the world. So the new Pope has got to get to his desk, look at his in tray and get a grip on what's going on in the church right away.
So, I mean, if we were talking about a US president, the first 100 days for the leader of the biggest Christian denomination in the world are going to have to be spent on very temporal matters, not matters spiritual.
Yes, they are. And but although these things intersect with each other as well, and he's going to have to fill an awful lot of offices around the church. He'll have to decide which and how many of Francis's officials he wants to keep in post in all of the key dicasteries within the Vatican. That's the ministries that the Pope oversees. Then he'll have to think about his schedule, where he wants to go to for his first trip. There'll be a lot of demand for the Pope to go to different places. He'll have to kind of engage in a kind of diplomatic negotiation with different parts of the Catholic world to see where he's going to start his pontificate and what message that will send. So there are lots of these practical, you've said, temporal matters which will need to be addressed, but they feed into the Pope's ability to deal with the kind of bigger spiritual, moral and ethical questions that are likely to dominate this pontificate, just as they dominated the last one.
By October, Leo issues his first major statement, a papal exhortation. It's called I Have Loved You. It echoes Francis with its fears of deepening economic inequality. As tech moguls amass extraordinary fortunes, Leo has some tough words about hoarding wealth. Sandy Cornish of Australian Catholic University sees a Pope ready to confront the crises of our age.
Its main message is really that love for the poor has always been and must always be a central feature of Christian living, that there can be no authentic Christian living without love for the poor. The last time we had a Pope Leo, at the time of the churches beginning to respond to the Industrial Revolution, and Leo XIII was the author of a landmark encyclical on the condition of the working classes. It's often thought of as the beginning of modern Catholic social teaching. So I think from that, we know that Pope Leo is actually very concerned about justice in society, the state of working people, the plight of the poor, the impact of new technologies on the lives of those who are most vulnerable and in need.
How did the Vatican respond, though, Sandy, to this question as to how much of this exhortation, this statement? It's not an encyclical, but it's pretty close to it. How did they respond to the idea that this is a legacy or even a remnant of Francis?
I was watching the launch of the apostolic exhortation online. Cardinal Czerny, who's the prefect of the Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development, was asked a number of times by journalists, you know, how much of this is actually Francis and how much is Leo? And in the end, he said, it's 100% Francis and it's 100% Leo. It's not the first time that a pope has actually issued a teaching document that has taken up and completed work begun by his predecessor. Leo is explicit about that in the beginning paragraphs of this document, just as Pope Francis was in his first major teaching document, where he completed an encyclical that Benedict had started on faith. So it's not unprecedented, and I imagine that probably also in years before that, the same kind of thing might have happened without being explicitly acknowledged in the text itself. Usually the Pope doesn't arrive at his desk with nothing on it.
As an Australian delegate to the Synod on Synodality, you got to see Francis up close. Does this exhortation from Leo, as we say, very much of a piece with Francis's thinking, perhaps reinforce the idea that Francis very much had, if not Leo specifically, then very much had a type of Pope that he wanted to succeed him?
I did have the great honour of meeting Pope Francis on three separate occasions, and he's certainly someone who loved people. At the Synod assemblies, there were times when he would arrive early for a session and he would sit for an hour and just meet person after person and engage with each one. And he really lit up when he was interacting with people. And I think that kind of commitment to people, a pastoral orientation, would have been something that he would have hoped for in a successor. But really, the whole process of electing a pope depends on the Holy Spirit. Francis was someone, particularly with his Jesuit and Ignatian spirituality, who really had great trust in the Holy Spirit.
Now, there's obviously a lot about almsgiving or charity that's directed to the comfortable, but that's par for the course, or generally speaking, for every Christian faith, and indeed for Muslims and Jews and many other faiths. But what does this statement say about structures, about ideologies that perpetuate economic inequality?
There's both an emphasis on almsgiving and an emphasis on economic and political structures. The exhortation is very clear that people aren't poor by chance or blind fate. People are made poor, pushed to the margins. These are results of the way in which we structure our economic and political and cultural lives. And that's really been an important dimension of Catholic social teaching since the 1960s. This is not something new in church teaching, but it's timely to be reminded that sometimes we can take these systems and structures, processes and institutions as though this is just the way things are, but they're actually built by human choices and kept in place by human choices.
Yeah, we're living in a world where two men, Larry Ellison and Elon Musk, have between them close to $1 trillion, which is the value of the GDP of multiple countries put together. I get the impression that Leo is very concerned about this accumulation of wealth, extreme wealth, because he does make some comments, does he not, about the structures that lead to this extraordinary accumulation and concentration of wealth.
Having wealth is not considered to be a moral issue for Christians, but what you do with your wealth and how you came by that wealth, what happens in our relationships with others in the process matters a great deal. And Pope Leo, of course, spent more than 20 years in Peru. He's a citizen of Peru, and we've seen the famous photos of him literally knee-deep in floodwaters with his community. He really wants us to understand our responsibility for one another, that accumulating grotesque levels of wealth in a world in which children are starving, a world in which people are without work, a world in which people are without hope, is just not a Christian stance.
This sentence leapt out at me. We paradoxically see the growth of a wealthy elite living in a bubble of comfort and luxury, almost in another world compared to ordinary people. I mean, he seems to be focusing on this idea that there is an illusion of happiness in accumulating wealth.
Yes, and I think this is something that we saw in Francis's teaching as well, placing so much faith in material goods and accumulation. It's a form of idolatry. It's a cultural and spiritual problem.
You've given a fair bit of attention to the role of women in church teaching. This is not specifically about women, but I think there's a reference to their being doubly poor.
Yes.
Under the current economic structures. Flesh that out.
It's really very significant to see that he has, in fact, acknowledged gender discrimination, other experiences of marginalisation and exclusion, so that women who are poor don't have exactly the same experience as men who are poor. Women with disability don't have exactly the same experience as men with disability. And when you have multiple bases for discrimination or disadvantage, you get quite particular experiences. So I think it's very important that he has acknowledged that. And women everywhere are always amongst the poorest of the poor. Mm. So when we talk about our preferential option for the poor, it also has to be a preferential option for poor women.
Leo has given no indication that he is prepared to change what now seems perpetual Vatican teaching, certainly on women priests, but maybe not even women deacons. I mean, where do you think he goes with this question of women's ministry?
I'll be very interested to see where he goes. At the moment, as a result of the Synod on Synodality, there's a working group looking at some of these questions. He may be waiting to see what advice they provide. He may well have very firm positions of his own. I'm not aware of what his own personal views are. It's a bit clearer that Pope Francis was more interested in new forms of ministry and participation than trying to change access to older forms of ministry and mission.
So far, Pope Leo is forging his own path, praying with King Charles, meeting with Hollywood celebrities, and making his first overseas trip in November to the Middle East. His papacy and legacy are both unfolding before us in real time. I'm Andrew West, host of the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and audio panel beater Roy Huberman.